Here we go. Ursula, under the weather. Get Tom in here. Hey, Tommy, get in here! Ursula spreading her germs again.
Tom's got it, too. Oh, my God. Run for the hills.
I couldn't tell. I thought Ursula sounded great.
Look at her, Tom.
I'm not feeling so. You know what? Visual. I love John is very perceptive. I'll give you that, John.
Thank you.
He's accusatory is what John is.
No. First I perceive, and
yeah,
then I
then
accuse.
You accuse.
All right?
Yeah.
And then I judge, and then I move on to the next person. All right, like something from Alien. The only reference I have to any sci-fi movie goes back 20 years ago. All right. By the way, everybody, congratulations. The City Council of Seattle has decided 9-0 that they want to tax jobs at $275 per person who has a job. If your business grosses, not nets, but grosses $20 million or more, you'll be paying that jobs tax of $275. Just as you predicted yesterday, Tom, kudos to you. You said the thing will pass.
True enough.
Yeah.
I rely on my sources and a hunch. Mm-hmm. I think that this is a compromise. This is half of what the city council wanted. It's pretty close to what the mayor tried to negotiate over the weekend, relatively successfully. And you've got Amazon more or less on board. Amazon is going ahead now with the construction of that building they put on pause. They're still on the fence about whether they will sublease the Rainier Square building. But still, Amazon has sort of bought into this enough that they are not threatening to leave, but they have put the city on notice. We feel like the hostile rhetoric has not been encouraging
sure,
to us.
Sure.
So any future developments. Now, I don't know if they will. I don't know how big they thought they were going to get here in Seattle. I mean, they already have 40,000. This will give another 40, go up to 48,000. I heard at one point the uppermost level they thought might be as high as 55,000. Mm-hmm. But still, I mean, given all the brouhaha, I think this is a pretty happy compromise.
Right. So rather than taking the whole hand, they took, what, two fingers?
Yeah, maybe
so. I mean,
so.
It's a compromise. What do they get out of it? They get nothing out of it. So Amazon gets nothing out of it.
Well, I mean,
and the businesses that make $20 million or more get nothing out of it. They're just pouring more money into a failed system. They don't benefit.
It's not failed.
Right.
Put that aside.
Okay,
forget
you're
whether
assuming,
it's a failure or not. No,
okay,
I'm not assuming anything. Let's just put that aside because whether it's failure or not, that's not what Amazon.
So tell me how the business benefits from paying this. Because if they're going to tax every job,
yes.
And if the same city council says, let's tax sugar so we'll get less sugar, we'll tax cigarettes, we'll get less cigarettes, we'll tax more alcohol, we'll get less alcohol sold. We're going to tax jobs, we're going to have just as many jobs created. Are we sending out a signal to anybody that wants to come to Seattle and start a business? Come here, we welcome your business.
Yes, as long as you are willing to be part of the solution to mitigate the downside of the success, the economic success that we've had in Seattle. And, I mean, Amazon has been a good neighbor until that point. They've poured, you know, more than they're being taxed here.
$31 billion. In five years.
No. I mean their charitable donations to. Nah. They haven't paid $31 billion into Mary's Place, but they've given more money than they're being taxed already to charitable situations like Mary's Place. We talked about that. The idea is to try to create a good neighbor relationship, and I think the mayor stepped in and said, listen, we don't want to spit in the face of these people that are giving this, you know, the engine of growth here in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's not insult them. Let's get them on board as a buy-in to see how much they're willing to go along. And that's what the compromise was. We'll have to see from here. Now, I noticed some of the four main council members, setting aside Sawant because she wasn't on the original legislation. Those four, a couple of them said yesterday, well, listen, you know, this is the best we could do right now, but we're going to go for more. It'll be interesting to see if that more is going to be more antagonistic or if they'll be outvoted now that we have this compromise under the mayor.
And how do we know that they're going to be responsible with the additional money they're taking from every single job? So here's the way they're going to divide it up. They say they're going to get, what, $25 million? Or what do they get, $40?
They figure they're going to raise between $45 and $49 million. 60 to 70% of that's going to go to affordable housing.
Right.
The remaining funds will go to shelters and other homeless services.
Okay, so they want to build, so they 66% they want to take out of the 45, so they're going to get about $20 million. And they want to build 591 homes, right? Affordable units. So then I did the math, and I asked a friend of mine who's a developer to do the math for me. I said, so if you have... if you have about, you want to try, you got about, so it looks like you're going to have about $43,000 per unit. That's what it's going to cost you. $43,000 per unit, 591 units. How big will the unit be? He says the unit will be anywhere between 150 feet up to 200 square feet, so each unit. So the affordable housing will be a small little shoebox of 150 to 200 square feet. That's what you get if you divide the 591 units, right? You get $43,000 per unit. That's the size of the square foot of each one, assuming that it costs $200 to build a unit. So just wondering, I wonder how they do the math. It's amazing that they're going to make this work.
Okay, but so that's a whole other realm. If we can look, into
it. No, it's not, Tom. It's how you, here's the thing. No, think of government just for an imaginary, just go way outside your normal scope of imagination on this. Imagine the government as a business. It's going to get capital infusion, which is $25 million. And what are you going to give us in return for that? Well, in return, we're going to build 591 units. And we're going to cost $43,000 per unit, and each unit will be 150 square feet, and it's going to reduce the homeless population. So what do we get for the investment of $25 million? We get 591 units, right?
Yes.
At 150 square feet. That's the reality. That's the way a business slash a government. Okay. Let's imagine a government running like a business to be responsible to shareholders. And the shareholders are the taxpayers.
I know, but what I'm saying, John, is neither of us have the details. My understanding was they hadn't gotten that specific.
But then,
what about the rental units? I mean, if you wanted me, I could go with the chart. Hannah Scott gave me an entire, it's a 2 pages of charts about where all this stuff is going to be broken down. So it's not just those housing units. But the thing is, in order to look at the mock-up, we don't have that kind of, you know, in-depth information. My hunch is they haven't worked all the details out yet, so they kept it general. That's why they're saying 60 to 70% for affordable housing. Remember, the initial legislation that the council, the four or five members of the council wanted to get through was they wanted all to go to affordable housing, and it was Jenny Durkin who said, no, we need to have other aspects to do, like needle cleanup and these kinds of other services, and they didn't want to split that. So this is offering much less than what the original five council members wanted, to service the impression, I think, that Seattle citizens have of the homeless problem, in addition to just creating the individual homes. But yeah,
and how would this not attract people if you're going to build new housing and it's terrific that they're going to take $25 million away and then they're going to put it into this program? How do they then guarantee that the person doesn't move from West Virginia or from Arizona or Nevada? What stops somebody from coming here from, say, Bellevue? What do you do to protect the shareholder,
Interesting, what's interesting about that is that you mentioned Bellevue. That Dow Constantine and Mayor Jenny Durkin have already, they came out, 10 days ago or so, and said, we need to work together. We need to approach this as a regional problem. And the inefficiencies that we have by having a Seattle jurisdiction and a King County jurisdiction, for instance, let alone other counties getting involved, we need to work together and spread some of the, not the wealth, but spread some of the pain. There's an interesting editorial maybe we're going to get to later about Bellevue not, paying its fair share. And then what happens with Bellevue, they shut down their winter shelter, and then everybody just gets on the bus and moves into Seattle for that. Why is Seattle on the hook for that? I think spreading the pain, I think, is a good and efficient, more efficient way of using it.
Right.
You're right.
You'll certainly attract more people.
So that, well, yeah, but from Bellevue, yes. Now, whether the influx from West Virginia is significant or not, we'll have to see.
Yeah. I saw a study that was done by the Commerce, I guess it was like a local Chamber of Commerce. They did a study on the homeless stuff. They found out in a survey, I don't know how many people they spoke to, the number one cause of homelessness was what? According to the survey they did.
Affordable housing?
No. A job loss. What
job
caused
loss. Okay, that makes sense. Okay.
So, job loss. So you lose the revenue, right?
Gotcha, yes. Okay,
and then you go into homelessness. Sense. About like 7 or 8 things down, it was they connected increased cost of rental units because of demand driving up more expensive units. But the number one thing was job loss. So I lost my job and I ended up homeless. Tom, the amount of jobs available right now, if you walk down this street from here to a mile down, you can see on windows of businesses hiring. Dishwasher, hiring this, hiring that. I realize the income is very low, but at least you get some job and maybe eventually start to be able to have some footing underneath you. So the idea that I lost my job and therefore I lost my house, perfectly understand that, read stories about that all the time, and talk to people that it happens to, but their jobs are out there. If somebody continues to live on the sidewalk and you subsidize their lifestyle, which doesn't ask them to do anything for all the stuff that they get, they will stay on the sidewalk. Don't you agree?
If you take care of my food and you take care of my clothing, and if you take care of additional expenses I may have, if it happens to be medical, what other expenses do I have and why should I bother to go get a job?
Because most people find justification for their own lives in having jobs. We've talked about this a bit yesterday.
We're not talking about most people. We're talking about a homeless population.
No, I know. Yeah, but I mean, the homeless population is made up of humans. I don't know if you think that's valid or not, but the idea is they're more like us than not. But here, as long as you mention what the most the common cause of homelessness, Pierce County most recent point in time count, the reasons people experience homelessness: number one, lack of affordable housing; number two, inadequate income or employment. So there's your job business and eviction. Top three causes of homelessness. And the same survey: mental illness, physical disability, and chronic health conditions. Yeah. Three most commonly reported disabilities. Substance abuse was fourth on the list. The idea here is that, yes, they all are interrelated. That's why it's such an intransigent issue, homelessness, because it's so complicated.
Yeah.
You've got individual isolated problems with certain people. You've got societal problems,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, like affordable housing and job loss.
Sure.
So the idea is it's this entire mix.
Right.
Now, your complaint, which I think is a valid one, everyone agrees, even the people in the government that are trying to handle this agree that we have not figured out how to deal most efficiently with the homeless issue.
Okay.
I think that's a serious concern, a serious issue. And Mayor Durkan, again, when she announced this compromise yesterday, when she got on board with it, says, yes, we understand. We've heard from the Seattle citizens loud and clear. We need accountability. We need to make sure that what we're doing, every penny that's being spent,
yeah.
is going to an effective, not just a good cause, but an efficiently productive cause.
Mm-hmm.
And that now with her in charge, okay. hopefully this will be the spur.
Let me ask you right. As a bleeding heart liberal, somebody who really cares, yes. about spending other people's money. Let's say we have 10 homeless people. 10 homeless people. And we're going to put them into the three categories that most of them fall into. Okay. Mentally ill. Okay.
Okay.
I
don't know if that's most. The people with
the
problems.
I'm going to divide them up.
There's mental,
up.
There's
mental illness.
Physical disabilities.
Okay.
Okay.
Let's say that of the three, one of them is the person just doesn't want to work. They actually just want. You don't believe that exists, do you?
No, I don't. I think it's a small minority.
Okay, well, that's your assumption. You have no research to back that up.
I'm operating like you.
No, I'm not saying everybody.
That's
I'm giving you three categories.
Yesterday.
Hold on. Okay. Giving you three categories. And one of the categories, whatever percentage of it is people that just don't want to work. We learned about the folks over in right out in front of Cairo Television. They're from West Virginia. They like their life. They don't want to go anywhere. They want to sit there on the sidewalk. Okay. So, of the three categories, and you only have $100 to spend on each one,
mm-hmm.
and you have got 10 people there, at some point, don't you realize as you give to somebody that actually could work and
yes.
contribute, by giving him that money, you're really taking it from somebody who needs it more.
Okay, that's
so
fine.
So
then
what do you do to vet those people out of the system so that they don't continue to enjoy the free ride?
I don't care.
What system do you have in place?
You can
for that?
Vet them however you want, John, but I don't think that's the biggest problem that we're grappling with.
Uh-huh.
The bigger problem. So the question is, the problem with the way we're approaching this is it's too simplistic for the reality, but still, it does allow us to prioritize.
Yes. Good.
So you have somebody who is not mentally ill and has no physical disabilities.
Yes.
Is not hooked on drugs or any kind of addiction. They're able-bodied, healthy people.
Lazy.
Who just through some unfortunate loss of a job or whatever, suddenly finds themselves homeless.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, those people do exist. And then you have somebody who is mentally ill and can't afford to live.
Yeah.
Do you give the money to somebody because we can give that money to that person and they will get out of their homelessness situation faster? Or do you have more sympathy for the person who is mentally ill and literally cannot get themselves up? Do you see it as a charity case or, a hand up to get them out?
I think
that's a tough thing to do because you could say all the money, all $100 should go to the person that can, eventually get a job or get a better education and get out of the homeless situation.
Right.
But we'd still have the charitable kind of cases where if somebody's has physical disabilities, their legs are blown off in mm-hmm. as a vet or something,
right.
we need to do both. That's what I would say.
So when this navigation team goes up to these people, what you find in most cases when they offer them services, they say no.
Yeah.
So it's at that point what you're saying is, I've got the money for you. You don't have to live on the street. are you willing to do this, this, and this? And they say, no, I'm okay. I'm quite content. Thank you very much. And I'll take your pamphlet so you feel like you've done something and see you later.
But we don't know.
And then
who
I'll
those
throw the pamphlets
are.
On the ground. So the thing is that if somebody refuses the service, what I'm just asking you for is let's be compassionate to those who really need it and also compassionate to those who are paying the bill. If you have a group of people, and I don't know what the percentage is, that simply say, you know what? I'm okay with this lifestyle. I'm sure it's miserable for most people.
Yeah.
But for them, it's like, this is okay, and I will take the handout.
Okay.
But by taking the handout, and you have the ability to paddle, you could put an oar in the water and paddle along with everybody else, but you choose not to. Mm-hmm. I don't know what percentage of that is, but really, that's a form of stealing from somebody who's mentally ill and truly does need the funds.
Okay, fine. And again, we're both in agreement that we don't know how much that is. Your prejudice is one way, my prejudice is the other way. Now, the question is, do you believe in a concept like basic income, which I thought you did? Then it doesn't matter if you work.
I am all in for basic income.
You are.
So Milton Friedman said basic income will work and only work if you have to do this first. You have to create borders and you must defend the borders.
Yeah.
If you say everybody, like if a restaurant down the street said, hey, everybody, everything's free, they would be out of business within an hour and 15 minutes, right? So the idea is that's why they have doors, and that's why they have locks, and that's why they charge people, and you can't just go in there and steal. If you had open borders and people would come in with guaranteed income, you would be wiped out immediately, right? Like the store that's offering free stuff. So the same thing with Seattle. Here's what I would do if I were in the city council. I'd say, you have to show me something, some information. Give me something that IDs you as a resident of Seattle. I don't care what it is. If you're coming in from some other city and you're taking advantage of the taxpayers of Seattle, that should not in any way be encouraged, and that person should not get a damn dime, orange, apple, or a pair of socks. I'm sorry, go somewhere else and take it from the Pierce County taxpayers. Seriously, Tom, you'll give me that, won't you?
Well, the thing is, I have no problem with setting up a kind of, I don't like this idea. It sounds like the pass laws in South Africa where blacks weren't allowed to be in certain neighborhoods. The problem is, right in this country, we have the ability to move. That's the problem. I mean, you cannot restrict my freedom. If I suddenly want to move to Tacoma for whatever reason, that we have to figure out a way to acknowledge that.
Yeah, but are you moving to get the freebies? Are you moving for the freebies? If you're moving for the freebies, then every time you offer freebies, like putting cheese out on a trap, you're going to get some rats, and people will go where the freebies are. And here's what Seattle has recognized. Hey, look at this. We've increased spending. Hey, look at this. We got more homeless. Hey, look at this. We increased spending. Hey, look at this. We got more homeless.
I know, but John. Okay,
and Tom,
John.
Why you deny that? That is plain fact. That's an XY axis.
It's not why, though. No. What? So you're telling me in Omaha, Omaha was offering Seattle what Seattle's trying to deal with the homeless. I think we have a homeless problem, so we try to respond to the homeless problem. And then as we respond to the homeless problem, we get more homeless. The homeless are on the West Coast. It's a huge problem in Seattle, in Portland, in San Francisco, in L.A. Mm-hmm. It's not that huge problem in the Midwest. There's something about the West Coast. People prefer to live out here. There are all sorts of reasons why maybe people get here. But we also are booming engines.
Right.
Right now, we have an economic engine in Seattle that is displacing people as it brings more people in. Would you also restrict people from coming from West Virginia if they're taking Amazon jobs? No. That's where it gets a little dicey, how we would control this.
The difference is one is generating and the other is just purely taking. We'll take a quick break. We'll come right back. Tom and Curly Show right
here. It's also generating more homeless, though, too. That's part of the problem.
And
that's what the head tax is.
I don't buy that one. We'll be right back. Tom and Curly right here in Cairo Radio. Thank you, Tom. What did he hit yesterday? 80-something? Is it 88?
88.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
A record.
Yeah, a record.
Those greenhouse gases, Kevin. Kiel Mortgage, 1-888-778-KIEL. Thanks, Kiel Mortgage. The folks to turn to, especially in an incredibly competitive market as we have right now. Get yourself the best team on your side, and that's got to be Kiel Mortgage. 1-888-778-KIELCL53969. Give Kiel Mortgage a little extra love, Tom, because I wasn't here on Friday to give him that kind of warm hug that I normally do, because I know you gave him the kind of backhand. Boo! Kiel Mortgage.
No, I gave you the backhand. I embrace Kiel Mortgage.
You did not. Did you really?
I said it twice.
Oh, my gosh.
Kiel Mortgage.
Here we go. You write to us at mynorthwest.com. You can text as well at 98973. You're a big part of the show. We do love hearing from you. Let Tom know where he's wrong and help him. Please help him, man. His age is always an open mind, willing to learn something new. So please text immediately at 98973. The Supreme Court says the Congress can't make states dance to its tune. This is yesterday's ruling regarding wager and betting going on in each state. The states, it was the NCAA, fought against it. And who was the other person that brought it against? It was NCAA and...
Well, I mean, most of the major sports operations are opposed to this because they're afraid that it's going to inflict corruption in the game.
Yes.
I was talking to Mike Salk quite vociferously this morning. Says, oh, yeah, like there's not, you know, corruption now. That NFL, I mean, the NBA referee, remember, who got caught? He was convicted of fixing all these games. I mean, calling them falsely and all this. But the idea is that they, the NCAA and, you know, the NBA and the NFL and all this, they like to think of themselves as holier than thou, and they're not going to allow gambling to somehow sully their noble efforts on the court.
So in 92, so was it 92 that the Congress came up with the idea that we here in Washington D.C. will make the decision that no state can have legalized gambling?
Yes. And what, so the big the decision yesterday sort of overturned that and said that it's unconstitutional. And it was a little odd because if Congress wanted to be more active, they could just pass a law, but they didn't. They were kind of They out-tricked themselves about what they could do. So New Jersey, very cleverly, New Jersey's been fighting for this for years and years and years, and they kept getting turned down in the courts. They finally decided they came up with a different law designed to bypass the rule. This one did not set up, and this is the tricky legal maneuvering, did not set up a licensed system of sports betting. In other words, New Jersey didn't come along and say, okay, we are going to do this, and here's how it's going to be run. All it did was, and this is what passed muster with the Supreme Court, it just repealed all state laws against sports betting.
Yeah.
So you were taking an inaction. You're just saying, okay, we're gonna lift these. We're not setting anything up. So there wasn't an active effort at overturning what the Congress had suggested. And because of that, they said, oh yeah, that you cannot be forced to enforce something that the feds are themselves not enforcing. Mm-hmm. So the significant thing here is, for sports betting, boy, ESPN was covering this like crazy. I mean, this is going to open up a can of worms.
All the states want some of that money, too.
Profits, yes. And including, in fact, what they suggest now is going to happen is that the leagues themselves, even though they supposedly were
against it,
they're going to negotiate a piece of that. And so everybody is going to benefit except for the poor sucker bets.
Not
or the bettors.
Necessarily.
Yes, necessarily.
No.
The bettors are going to come. This ahead. I know. You want the freedom.
I've done it, Tom.
As a good libertarian, I agree with you. Let them, if you want to risk that money, some people can make a living at it.
Right.
But that's like,
I don't
you know,
like that
less
the
than
state
1%.
Does it. I don't like the state runs probably one of the worst betting schemes ever. And it's all tax dollars supported with advertising and with the lottery. I mean,
well,
you're selling a bunch of people that can't afford it a dream. And what would be your dream?
That's right.
In some sort of house. And most of the people that buy those things can't afford those tickets. They could spend the money on something else.
That's probably also true of the bettors, too, the gamblers as well. I mean, that was Mike Salk's take was, he says, I'm never, you know, comfortable with rich people taking money from poor people. And he sort of thinks the people that are going to be invested in the gambling industries are going to be rich. And the people that are giving them the money willingly, grant you, are the ones coming out in the losing end of things.
I got caught up in it in 1986. And a friend of mine was into it. And he said, hey, you want to bet the Eagles game? I said, sure. He goes, give me $100. They called it punting a bullet. I don't know where they got that from. And so I gave him $100 on Thursday. And then the Eagles won. So he comes in on Monday, says, hey, here's your $300 or whatever, $185. I made $85. Yeah. I was like, oh, great. And then Thursday, hey, you want to bet some more games? And he slowly got me into the thing. At one point, he said, hey, do you want your winnings? Or you want to roll them? I mean, roll them into the next bet. I said, let's roll them into the next bet. So then I had like six games on the line. I lost it all. And I lost like $3,000 or something. And he came to me on Monday and said, hey, you owe me $3,000. I said, I don't have $3,000. And he said, well, you got to have it to me by Friday. I said, I can't get it by Friday. He said, who do you think you're dealing with here? And I said, I don't know. And he said, I said, you.
Yeah.
You, Bill. And he goes, not me.
Yeah.
People will want their money on Friday. They know where you work. They will come beat you up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was it for me. I said, forget it. I'm never going to do that again. I borrowed the money from three friends, and I never bet again. But you make some money, you might lose some money, but that people do it because they can possibly have better odds winning there than certainly the lottery.
Yeah, or they may get beat up like you were threatened.
No. Now that it's legal.
No, but the significance of this, though, in the article that Andrew found us is the analysis, and this is in The Atlantic, says, you know what this does, though? This is this is going to perhaps affect something that is completely independent of sports betting. He says this should be very germane to the discussion about sanctuary cities.
Right, because the power of the federal government saying to states, hey, you have to enforce these laws, these federal laws, and here we go, the states are saying, no, we are independent of the things that you want us to do.
Yes.
So therefore, now we see a flip-flop, right, where Republicans were all about the fact that, hey, we want these cities to bend to the will of the federal government to go get people that have snuck into this country illegally and dispel them.
Yeah.
Now you have the Republicans supporting this, the Federalist idea, as opposed to they sort of pick and choose which one they want to be for.
Yeah, in this case, though, I mean, the ramifications of this case, because most of the conservatives on this, the hunch was in the Trump administration that the conservatives would rally around the Trump administration's position that they want to withhold federal funds from people, from cities that aren't willing to enforce federal law enforcement. And this particular article is talking about that's going to be tougher for the justices to do. He says, now, it's a new enough and malleable enough ruling that maybe somebody like Alioto can figure out some kind of distinction, you know, without real merit, but maybe be able to slice and dice. But in general, it's going to be tougher to justify sanctuary cities given the ruling the Supreme Court just made on sports betting. So, boy, you talk about two completely different universes.
So you start from the individual's rights, then you go from the individual to, let's say, the city, and then from the city to the county, and the county to the state, and then the state to the federal. Here you have this example of it happening in California, where California has passed this, I forget what it's called, and basically we're going to be a sanctuary city, that's what we are, we're all about sanctuary cities, and then various little cities are coming along and suing and saying, you can't do that to us, we want to be able to figure out how we're going to spend our money in order to uphold the laws that we think are constitutionally granted through the federal government.
That's right. So yeah, you have all these different levels. The feds make a ruling, the states don't like it, the states make a ruling, then the cities don't like what the state does. So like what Seattle's trying to do is raise a city income tax, and the state is telling us, you know, is telling the city of Seattle, no, or they're looking at it, that we don't think that's constitutional. And yeah, it's where the jurisdictions are. And the idea was, if it's not prohibited, you know, in the Constitution, if the Constitution doesn't say anything about it and Congress doesn't say anything about it, then it reverts to the states.
Right.
I don't know if they ever made it smaller than that. Like, if anything that isn't claimed by the feds and isn't claimed by the state, then the city has a, you know, jurisdiction or not. But it definitely, states do have jurisdiction over everything that isn't federally mandated by either the Constitution or Congress.
I was on the city council, and you always, we'd come up with something, and then a city manager would say, state's not going to allow that. They said, federal government's not going to allow that. So you always have these confines on certain things, right?
Yeah.
All right. Is it possible that you're sitting in your office and you text somebody a message while they're driving a car, and then an accident occurs? Who's responsible for the accident? The answer will surprise and shock you. Now, remember, there's only two people involved in this equation. What's the most shocking answer? Right back. Okay, so there's a woman in Pennsylvania, and she is driving her car, and she's getting text messages from two different people. She looks down at her phone, as people do while they're driving, and she hits a motorcyclist and kills him, Tom. Mm-hmm. The case goes before a judge, and the judge says, you know what? Yes, you're liable, but I also think that the people that were texting you are also liable in the death of that motorcyclist, because they had knowledge that you were driving at the time. And they knew that you may be looking at those text messages. So I'm not going to say they're guaranteed to be included in this, but I'm not going to exclude them from the possibility of being sued.
That's the key, is that there is a degree of liability that this judge is allowing for. If you knowing, like if I knew you were driving and I was texting you and I knew that you were texting me back, so we were in the midst of it and you kept saying, well, you know, I'm driving, I got to keep my eyes on the road, but let's keep doing this kind of stuff. If you could establish that I knew that you were driving and I continued to text you and you were getting responses, then in some degree I could be seen as liable. And the reason that's significant is because right now there's no, you know, there hasn't been a built up of much case law with this, but they do have two or three cases where the judges have ruled that you are not immediately sort of freed of any guilt. Right. Because, you know, who would you know? But you certainly have to be convinced. Like, I could send you a text. I have no idea where you're, if I'm sending you a text, what you're doing. You may out, be out, you know, sitting in your backyard. I mean, you may.
By the way, let the record show. I've known you for 5 years. I've never gotten a text from you.
It's true.
Okay.
Do I know your phone? I'm not even sure I know your
phone
number.
That's why. That's why you don't get texts.
Exactly. I'm a big texter. I'm sure you figured that out. I text three.
Tom still fax me things.
Yeah, that's right. And you never respond.
I don't respond anymore.
Yeah, you always hear that high squeaking up pitch. So the thing, though, here is that you have to prove that you knew.
Yes.
Like, if I just send you a text, I didn't know. So I know she's driving to Spokane. I didn't know that she'd be checking your text then. I just want to make sure when she got to Spokane, hey, don't forget, you got to pick up, you know, whatever once you get to Spokane. And so all this article is really establishing is, could you get sued for texting someone while driving? Yes, there is precedent for that to be considered. In the three cases that allowed for that, though, in all three cases, none of them were convicted or found liable. Okay. But it just gives you sort of a heads up as we start building case law that they haven't ruled it out. Because when we first heard it, I thought, that's ridiculous.
Yes.
But, yeah, the idea is if you know and they're continuing to do that.
Yeah. Also, you had to actively encourage him to text her while he was driving. That was the encourage of, you know, write me back.
Well, right. And one of the things is this kind of control. So imagine a really domineering boyfriend and his girlfriend is out driving and he's like really, you know, kind of verbally abusive.
Yeah.
If you can be seen as control, actually having some kind of psychological control over the person that's driving, a bit like, remember that case where the girlfriend convinced the boyfriend to kill himself and he didn't want to and she did? I mean,
get
that kind
back
of
in the car.
Insistent stuff. He said, get back in the car and drive and text me while you're driving kind of stuff. So it is allowed, but I think in 99% of the cases, I can't imagine it would actually come to fruition that you would be liable. But I suppose there are exceptions.
It makes sense we know that texting and driving is against the law.
Right.
So you are, in effect, you're an accomplice to the law being broken because you're also texting. If you were in the car with the individual and you put your hand over their eyes as they were driving, just as a joke every once in a while, blind driver, right? And they run into somebody. I guess the guy that put the hand over the eyes would be more culpable more so than the driver.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the driver, if the driver is encouraging, hey, do that thing where you cover my eyes again, then the two are in, cahoots and end up taking someone's life, and then they're both liable.
Yeah, and then liable, but doesn't mean, a percentage of liability. You're not totally liable.
Let's see. We'll get to the story we didn't get to because you're so busy going around and around and around and around on homeless stuff. But Lakewood wants to curb panhandling, telling people to keep the change. Plus, what does the average panhandler make in a day? Interesting guy from Oregon, after graduating with 2 degrees from college, decided he would try it out, Tom, just for 12 days. And he's broken it all down. And he says one of the things that's most encouraging is it reinforces your faith in humankind.